Welcome. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. And today I'm pleased to have back Tricia McCannon. And we're talking about her new book, Jesus, The Explosive Story of the 30 Lost Years in the Ancient Mystery Religions. We had reviewed half of the book, and I had invited her back on to review, do an update, but also review the second half of the book in more detail, where we talk about Jesus's lost years, specifically in the Far East and in Egypt. Tricia, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Susan. It's always such a pleasure to get to talk with you for any reason. I know how busy both of us are, so it's great we get to talk on the radio.
Yeah, it is. So you just got back from a book tour, is that right?
Yeah, I have certainly had a really busy year since the book came out in March, and I've gotten to be in, I think I've spoken in North Carolina, Utah, Arizona, 2 weeks in Arkansas at Dolores Cannon's wonderful conference in June, and I was in Europe and England in August, home in September, and I've just come back from about 7 weeks where I was speaking in about six cities, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Jose, Las Vegas, Kansas City, and Columbus, Ohio. So it's been a very busy fall.
Well, your book certainly has revealed some things that have never been revealed before, plus has put together, I guess, the most comprehensive text, and I guess, bridging the mystery with what we know about Jesus.
Yes, as we all know, it just seems like that we have, most of the Western world comes from a Judeo-Christian background. However, as we all know, that background actually had a basis. It had a foundation. And some think, of course, Christian mysteries go back to the Jewish mysteries, and certainly the Jewish mysteries are woven into some of them, but it had a far deeper foundation, and that foundation was what were called the great spiritual mysteries that existed on the planet and flourished some 4,000 years before Jesus was born and some 400 years after he died and the crucifixion. So what my book really addresses is it introduces readers across the world who have no knowledge. They've often wondered what really, how does Christianity really fit together? And there's a lot of beautiful truths in it, but because there's been a lot of editing, shall we say, over the course of the last 1600 years for social and political agendas, a lot of the pieces of the puzzle are missing. And so this book really helps to fill in the pieces of the puzzle by first introducing the mysteries and the foundation from which Christianity was originally drawn, and then going through Jesus' life and his journey through those 30 missing years before his ministry really starts, and talking about where he went, who trained him, and how what they taught and how it's actually reflected in his teachings, not to mention, as I think I've shared with you before, I have gotten access to some of the many 570,000 documents hidden in the Vatican, mm-hmm. as well as other secret texts that really give a much deeper insight into the depth and breadth of Jesus' teachings.
Well, it seems like there might have been an agenda to keep a lot of this history under the bed, so to speak. If Jesus was born divine, just up from birth, and all of these things just simply occurred, then the church would be much better protected than if the actual path that Jesus took to obtain his divinity was revealed.
I think you're very right. Even within the early centuries of the church, this was a very big debate. Was Jesus born divine and he just knew everything from the beginning, or was he born human and he came into his divinity and his awareness of that divinity and then fully inhabited it? And You know, I think at one level we could say that we're all born divine. We're all sparks in the great body of God, or atoms in the body of God. But of course, most of us are very unawakened and unaware of the purity of who we are behind the many social masks that we learn to wear in order to, you know, live in the third dimensional world. And Jesus was certainly one who, I think, had penetrated all of those masks and was able to see, you know, through those masks with all the people he met, going right to the divinity of the people that he encountered, which of course is one of his profound secrets behind his healing. Because what's healing but bringing us back into alignment with the divine plan, back into the alignment with wholeness?
Right, and he was able to do this with everybody, and I think he got in a little bit of trouble in India because he didn't respect the caste system, and even in the Middle East when he was accused of hanging out with thieves and whores, and it's just interesting that he didn't go along the class lines in any of the places that he was.
Yeah, you know, most people don't realize that, you know, I talk about in my book, and I think we started speaking about this many months ago when the book first came out in the spring, that he had gone with his parents, as we all know, to Egypt, to the city of Alexandria. He was there till he was about 7. Then we know he traveled with Joseph of Arimathea and his mother, Mary, up to the Druids, which were, the Druids had 60 universities and 60,000 students, and, you know, the highest level children of the Greek and the Romans were actually sent for education to the Druid Isles, because it was a very thorough, advanced program that took 20 years. So he visited there when he was 7. We know he began studying with the Essenes from 8 till about 13. And then we've got him back in the Druid Isles about the age of 14 or 15. And we know he was there a couple of years. But then he was so advanced that they said, send him on to India. So I think when we completed our show last time, we were picking up with India. And you're exactly right with what you've said, is that much of the world was involved in a certain level of caste system. You know, if you were born a prince, you were always a prince, unless someone cut off your head. If you were born a street sweeper, you couldn't become a prince. It was not like our presidential system now, where you can rise to and transcend your class based on your intelligence and your merit. You could only get so far. So in India, there were several classes. The Brahmin class was the one that for thousands of years had passed down the oral and then later the written traditions of the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Puranas. And I'm sure many of those people were very, very evolved. But then as we come down, we have the military class and the noble class, you know, the ruling classes, and then you have the merchant class and the artisan class, and then the farmers, the peasants, and finally the untouchables. And those last three classes were never allowed to hear any holy scripture at all. And then I think the most of the upper three classes, with the exception of the Brahmins and maybe the nobility, were only allowed to hear holy scripture once a year at festivals. Right. And so Jesus, being the incredible Democrat that he was, knowing that all souls have an equal right to enlightenment, taught everyone equally. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he went through the traditional studies and the Hindu teachings. He graduated from those traditions, so he familiarized himself to be able to speak the language both literally and, you know, religiously. And then he began teaching his own wisdom to everyone and very quickly acquired about 3,000 to 5,000 followers, is what the histories tell us. And then this, of course, was very threatening, because it was people that normally didn't get to hear this kind of spiritual revelation. So there was a plot that was hatched to basically, you know, do away with him. And I have two historical accounts that talk about, one that says that he was warned by the farmers and the peasants, and the other is that the Magi appeared to him. And it's, of course, probable that both happened. The Magi, being members of the Great White Brotherhood, could easily have appeared in spirit form or even physically before the farmers and peasants. But he fled then to a place called Rajagira, which was long known as a site where the Buddha had lived. And there was a great Buddhist monastery there up in the mountains. And he lived there for 6 years, learning the language of Pali, P-A-L-I, and being able to read Buddha's scriptures from 500 years earlier directly. And he was actually embraced and acknowledged and recognized by the Buddhist as the second Buddha that the first Buddha had prophesied would come 500 years after him. So that's very, very interesting. And, of course, many scholars in the last 100 years have remarked upon the incredible correspondences between Buddha's life, Jesus' life, Buddha's teachings, Jesus' teachings, and, it can't be completely accounted for by the fact that the Buddhist missionaries were in England or Britain, or that the Buddhist missionaries were all throughout Egypt. It's at a much deeper level than that.
And you actually have an appendix in the back of the book comparing their two lives.
Yes, it's just remarkable about their deeds. Both of them were known to have healed the sick, raised the dead, walked on water. Both talked about the fact that the kingdom of heaven is within us, that we should not judge, or that we ourselves would attract judgment if we set in motion the wheels of judging others. They talked about the importance of karmic law, but that love can transcend karmic law, that through the power of forgiveness, karma can be banished. So this is all very amazing stuff. So, I wound up in the process of writing this book, as I said, getting access to some very, very interesting documents, including documents that existed for a long time in a library called the Himis, H-I-M-I-S, the Himis Monastery. And it's very high up. I think it's 11,000-12,000 feet above sea level. And it was a place that a lot of the ancient hidden documents were taken because of its inaccessibility. And there was a man in the 1800s named Nicholas Natovich who had heard that there were these secret books about Jesus over there. And he went in search of them, and he went to that monastery and asked the head lama, and the head lama was not going to, reveal this to some outside Westerner. And so the lama said, no, just a rumor. And so Natovich left, and on his way down the mountain, he fell off his horse and broke his leg, fractured his leg. And he was taken back to the monastery because it was the closest place and was interred there for many months recovering. Well, obviously the lama took this as some kind of a spiritual sign that actually it was okay for him to release this information. So he showed up with these large volumes of text about the record of Jesus being there. And over a period of months, Natovich, copied them down and translated them and then put them in order. And in the mid-1800s, around 1860 or 70, he published these as St. Issa, Best of the Sons of Men. And, of course, Issa means firstborn, and it's connected with actually Brahma, the principle of creation. That was one of the names for Brahma, Issa Ra Anima Heritu, which is the firstborn light, Issa Ra Anima, that animates the truth or the power of the word. And Jesus called himself Issa wherever he went, which was wonderful. I love that. You find references to St. Issa and place names to St. Issa, also the Celtic Isles and India and so forth. And then he, so Natovich published them. And then years later, in the early 20th century, the famous statesman and painter Nicholas Rorick, who has a gorgeous gallery of his incredible paintings of the Himalayas. His wife, Helena, and his grown son, George, who spoke something like 11 or 12 languages, they made a trek over to the Himalayas in search of the same information. They wanted to find out if it was true, and they again wound up connecting with the Himis Library. They confirmed it. There were many other people from a Supreme Court judge to a researcher from the National Geographic Society that saw these records, and I'm sure the records have been moved since then because now, you know, it's become too public and they would be in jeopardy. But I wound up getting access to some of this information while I was writing the book. Very interesting.
Well, that's again what we were saying before, that the powers that be may not want information out that contradicts the idea that Jesus' divinity was primary, and that none of us mere mortals can embark on this path because we weren't born divine like Jesus.
Well, of course, Jesus himself says, you know, these things I do, you too shall do and greater.
Right.
So, you know,
exactly.
He tells us right up front, you know, I'm laying a path for you, and you too are capable of achieving this, let us say, Christic consciousness, if you want it, if you're willing to do the work to get to there,
That
point, you know. So, and I talk about the whole idea of divinity in the book in a very interesting concept that most Westerners know nothing about, the concept of the four great Kumaras.
I was just about to ask you about that. That's on page 343.
Have you, with all your crazy busy schedule, have you had a chance to read the book?
I have.
Oh, my gosh, did you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah. I thought it was fabulous.
You know, it's. Thank you so much. I really hope that word gets out about this book, because what it does is, with incredible honoring and respect to Jesus, in a way that even if you never even cared about Jesus, or you didn't like him, or you thought he was like some kind of a plastic icon, it makes you really become aware of him at the deep soul level, and the beauty and the power of who he really was.
And how much work he did to get where he was going.
Oh.
And this guy didn't study for like 10 years. This guy studied for, 30 years?
his whole life.
I mean, his whole life. Even as a child, he was immersed in these studies.
Totally.
And probably because he, without the discipline that the studies afforded him, he might inadvertently misuse his powers. That's the other thing.
Right. In the book, you know, the book is divided into five sections. You know, in the very beginning, couple of chapters, I introduce the mysteries and their structure and how they honored the divine feminine and masculine, which is something that, you know, we kind of lost for many, many hundreds of years within Christianity. I think Mary got a halo in the 9th century, and the apostles had halos in the 6th century. So it took her another 3 centuries to be allowed to be, you know, have a halo. So, yeah, it tells you something about the balance. And, of course, we can perceive that our world has been very heavily tilted towards the masculine patriarchy. So we really lost balance in the way that Christianity got presented. Where was I going with that? We were going down a particular path of we're talking about his time in the Himis Library. I mean, the Himis Library and his time in India, and the Kumaras, the four Kumaras.
Right. Yeah. Before we get to that, though, I just want to emphasize how much study he did, and you outlined it beautifully in the Egyptian part, where he had to go through all of these different initiations. And then finally, the final initiation, where he went through a near-death experience. But we can talk about that in a minute. Let's go back to the Kumaras.
Well, actually, you know, you just picked up beautifully where I was when I said the book was in five sections. We're introducing the mysteries. The second section, we talk about you know, his birth and what really the Star of Bethlehem might have been and when really was he born, because there were some very important birthdays in terms of the energetics and the astronomy, the astrology, and also the hermetics of his birthday. Then we go into the third section about what was really happening in glorious Egypt, which was really the New York City of its day. It was certainly not poor and downtrodden or uneducated. And then what did the Essenes really teach? And most people don't realize that the Essenes were members of the Great White Brotherhood and that they taught angelology. They were very familiar with working with angels. And Jesus himself, in the Essene Gospels of Peace, teaches about 14 angels. Angels of seven male and seven female, mm-hmm. angels of the air and the sun and the water, and he teaches a lot about how to stay healthy, how to eat living food instead of dead food, how to what we would call alkalize your body,
right.
through things like fruits and vegetables and fasting through or doing colonics. I mean, mm-hmm. he was really knowledgeable about all this because of his Essene training, and. Then the next section of the book goes into the Celtic, which I just love because we finally get into the Tree of Life and the Great Cosmic Egg and the One World Tree and some of the deepest mysteries that were known to mystics about what how the world unfurled, how the whole mm-hmm. universe came into being, and how it's reflected as a microcosm within the macrocosm. And then we move into the Indian and the Persian sections, and then our last section, of course, is the 7 years he spent training in Egypt before really starting his ministry, probably closer to the age of 37, 38, 39, even maybe 40, which is probably the only place in my book where I give any variance to, let us say, the traditional thing mm-hmm. that we all believe in the Bible. And as I pointed out, the reason we believe he started his ministry at 30 is because Luke says he appeared to be a man around 30. And Luke,
but that's he appeared to be a man. He probably looked very young because of his spiritual work.
I think you're totally right. Plus, of course, Luke never knew Jesus.
Exactly.
He was with Paul. He came after.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was just repeating the legends.
Right. He appeared. That's what he looked like. And as we know, many of the great spiritual leaders do not age rapidly.
Exactly. They're timeless.
If at all,
Yes, some of them stay young for a long time.
That's right.
Then we have, of course, the Gospel of John, who seems to indicate Jesus was closer to being someplace in his 40s or even closer mm-hmm. to 50. Because in the Gospel of John, which I think is the earliest of all the four Gospels in the mm-hmm. in the Bible, Jesus is talking to some Jews and saying, before Abraham was, I am. And the Jews are like, what, man, are you crazy? You're not yet 50. You can't, you know, you can't
right.
be that old.
Yes.
And that's not something you'd say to a 30-year-old.
No, that's probably a lot more accurate, because I think you have to look at the words. Luke said he appeared to be a man around 30, and that doesn't mean he was, you know, he told people he was 30.
Exactly.
So the
7 years in Egypt, of course, was very critical, and I talk mm-hmm. about this whole idea, as you were saying, about how within the great schools of initiation at the very highest level, which was in Egypt, mm-hmm. they didn't just know about the seven energetic bodies around the human body, but they knew about two additional ones, the nine bodies. And these two additional ones are the ones that, through mastering them, it allowed Jesus to go through this, let us say, transmutational process that allowed him to literally die and then be able to resurrect his body
mm-hmm.
and to change the form of how he appeared.
Right.
Now, this is very interesting. Most Christians know nothing about this. But when you study some of the other Gospels of the other apostles that were not put into the Bible, but were nonetheless were written by the apostles, who knew him, they talk about the fact that after Jesus, you know, officially died and was resurrected, he would appear to them in different forms, sometimes as what they knew of as himself, sometimes as a young child, sometimes as an old man, sometimes mm-hmm. as a man his own age, but not looking quite like mm-hmm. himself. So because of that, he gained the ability to be able to change his form.
Right.
Because ultimately, you know, there's energy, then there's light, and then there's matter. And so whatever these initiations were that the Egyptians knew and he didn't, it allowed him to be able to control his energy and his light bodies enough to change his physical appearance.
Yeah, he could also leave, his consciousness could leave his body and travel and, you know, have experiences and then come back and he could remember them.
Yes, that would be soul travel.
Mm-hmm.
Soul travel, you know, when I was 19 years old in this lifetime, I encountered a group of very powerful masters called the Viragi Masters. And Virag means truth or detachment in Sanskrit. And these masters actually taught the spiritual technology of learning how to do exactly what you said, mm-hmm. to project your consciousness beyond your physical body and to travel in the inner realms and to return and remember it.
Right.
And so from the time I was about 19 in this lifetime, I had the great honor of being their student mm-hmm. and learning these specific techniques, which I teach in the mystery school that I teach here in Atlanta and the Phoenix Fire Lodge, the Order of the Eagle and the Dove.
Do you want to give your website information so in case anybody wants to investigate that, they can go to that?
Absolutely. It's www.TrishaMcCannonSpeaks.com, and Tricia is spelled TRICIA, and McCannon is just like it sounds, Mac and Cannon, MCCANNON. And TrishaMcCannonSpeaks.com. And let me say it's a really good site, but I am in a process actually of putting up a completely new site, which will probably be up by the beginning of the year, with that same URL. But,
okay.
you know, you can go to it, you can learn about, I have about 21 DVDs and 6 CDs and 2 books. My earlier book, Dialogues of the Angels, is listed. And we're actually down to our last 30 copies of that incredible book. We've sold over 10,000 copies of it. And that one is all about the masters and the fairies and, you know, many other levels. So if people want to check that out or the mystery school, I'm traveling a lot now, and so I haven't had a chance to start a new session of the mystery school. But like the ancients did, they have 3 levels of teaching. And so the same thing with my school. The first year is about 9 weekends over the course of about 1 year and 3 months, and then if people choose to, they can go on to the second level, which really encompasses a lot of the Egyptian mysteries, and it's the same format, 9 weekends over the course of about 1 year and 3 months. And I'm probably going to be starting a new round of the mystery school in January, so anyone who's interested can email me at TrishaMcCannonSpeaks@yahoo.com. So I can get your email and just give me your phone number and I'll call you up and we'll chat about, you know, what you're interested in and what your qualifications are and, you know, how much spiritual study you've done so you have some foundation under you. So, so yes, do you want to go back to the Kumaras?
Yes, let's do the Kumaras, the 4 great Kumaras.
Don't you love that concept?
It's great.
Well, for those who don't know, the word Kumara is a Sanskrit word meaning son, like a son of, you know, a son of God. Mm-hmm. So in the Vedas, they talk about the fact that there are these 4 great Kumaras. And within the ancient mysteries, it was known that the Divine Mother principle comes into the world again and again and again. That's why in Egypt, she was known as Isis, or the I Am principle of the Divine Feminine, is. Isis, she of 10,000 names and 10,000 faces, because mm-hmm. they knew that she comes in, you know, as, you know, Kuan Yin, Radha, Soma, Lakshmi, you know, Durga, Isis, Aphrodite, Venus, Ishtar, Ceres, Demeter. I mean, there's many, many names and many, many cultures. But the Divine Father principle, it was believed, did not come into the world directly. He who spins the galaxies, who is the great spiral, the great eagle, that he only came in through incarnating in these four Kumaras, or these four divine sons of God, and that periodically, every few thousand years, one of them comes to the planet. And they are basically Sanat Kumara, who is the head of the Great White Brotherhood, Sananda Kumara, who was Jesus, and I believe an earlier incarnation of him was Osiris, because basically the Christ principle in Egypt was held within the concept of Osiris, who very similarly to Jesus traveled the world, helped humanity, and in the end was taken up by the dark forces, and through the power of love, Isis raised him from the dead. Mm-hmm. He was resurrected. So it's a very similar template. And then you have Sananka Kumara, who was, of course, Thoth. And Sananka's thing was to set up the great mystery schools and all the satellites around the world. And that's exactly what Thoth did. He, you know, he was known as Quetzalcoatl in South America and Central America. You know, he set up the Druid teachings, the Egyptian teachings. He invented the 26-letter alphabet that we have today so that knowledge could be recorded and not lost. It's said that he actually brought the Indian people Sanskrit, which is a language, one of the languages of light, where the sound produces a shape and the shape produces a sound, much as we see with Hebrew or Aramaic, but probably predating either one of those languages. You know, he was called the god of wisdom in ancient Egypt, and later the Greeks called him thrice great Hermes or Hermes Trimegistus. And then finally, the last of the Kumaras was known as Sanandana, not Sananda, but Sanandana or Sanansana with a TH. And his energy, they say he comes the least often to the planet, only, you know, every, whatever, 5 or 10,000 years. And basically, his profile is that, like the others, he's a shepherd, he's a poet, he's a musician, a minstrel, a healer, but then he has to sort of pony up at a time of great darkness and fight back the dark, literally, in war. And so he would have incarnated as a Horus in ancient Egypt at a time when the evil Set, his evil uncle, had murdered his father Osiris, and basically thrown Egypt into chaos for 350 years. So Horus is the one who came along, who brought balance back to the force and restored order to Egypt and brought the light back, the light shower, the way shower. I believe he also may very well have incarnated as Rama in the Vedic story of the Ramayana and as Krishna in the Vedic story of the Mahabharata, because, again, similar MOs, beautiful, pure, high-vibrating healer, musician, shepherds of great wisdom who had to, who incarnated in a time of great darkness where there were great warring forces of darkness that were taking over the planet. In the case of the Ramayana, it was the demon who was probably a reptilian alien. They call them a Rakshasa, who was, you know, raiding monasteries and killing priests and leaving them half eaten, you know, which was terrorizing the people. And that Rakshasa or reptilian was named Ravana. And what's so interesting, I have this very beautiful translation of the Ramayana, where, you know, Rama, this noble prince, and his beautiful wife, Sita, wind up, you know, going into the forest and coming to a place where they become aware of this war, and Sita's kidnapped, and so Rama has to go and get her back, and the animals all help him, and there's a war. And finally, when Rama is defeating this reptilian, Rama says to him, you know, why did you do this? Why rain all this destruction? And Ravana, the reptilian, gives this incredible speech, and he says, oh, my great Lord, know you not who you are? You know, that you are, you know, an incarnation of the Divine Father down here on earth. And I could not get your attention in any other way.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I thought I would come to Earth and make such a stink that you would have to come down, and at least, even if it's that you only annihilate me in this battle, at least mm-hmm. I would get your attention because of my devotion to you.
Oh, my goodness.
Is that an amazing turn of events?
That's like the archetype for every 4-year-old who throws tantrums all the time to get attention.
Oh, completely. You are just so completely right. So, I mean, it's just, it almost makes you weep when you realize here's this guy who's been, you know, throwing a tantrum and causing just, you know, complete havoc for everyone in every mm-hmm. direction. And, you know, when we finally find out his motives, it's like, know you not who you are.
Yeah,
you know?
Really.
I thought that was just great. So, you know, I talk about these four great Kumaras, although the focus of this book, of course, is on the beautiful Sananda Kumara, or Jesus. And I show the correspondences between Jesus and Osiris. And when you understand that these are eternal beings who come down from time to time, and yes, I mean, the question you pose, are they divine or are they human that become divine? I mean, ultimately, we are all divine, but most of us are unaware of it, and we certainly don't act like it if we are. So the difference in these people, these beings, is that they are, let us say, far purer emanations who are aware of the beauty of their own divinity. And it doesn't mean that they don't have to come and go through their own trials and tribulations. But, you know, it might or might not ever even occur to them to think of themselves as, you know, emanations of the Divine Father, just as, you know, Ravana says to Rama, do you not know who you really are down here?
Right. Yeah.
You know, but they look at themselves as beings just like we do, who are in service to the Divine and who are here to light the way so that the rest of us can remember our own divinity and give us an example for how to live.
That's true. And, you know, we glean from some things that Jesus said. He knew a lot of what was going to happen, and it didn't always sit well with him.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, he had a... Before he went into the desert, I guess, for his 40-day and night fast and purification, he really was a little disturbed with what he knew was going to happen.
Yeah, and of course the Garden of Gethsemane, I mean, he's like, hey, do I really have to do this?
If you're right.
I have to, I will.
But,
you know, I am really not very pleased that I have to do it. Could you take this cup away?
Yeah, really.
And, well, you know, I talk about in this book, and I think this is one of the things I discovered in my research that was so amazing, you know, why the whole cross thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
why did he die on a cross? Okay, well, I mean, at the most superficial level, we can say, hey, it was the Romans put people to death that way.
Right.
But, I mean, what was the deeper hermetic mm-hmm. purpose of it? And as I explained, the cross was always looked at as the grid of space-time.
Right. I always knew that. I went around telling people that. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, Susan,
I don't know where I read that. I don't think I ever did. I just knew it.
Well, you know, you yourself are an incredibly amazing being. I mean, I could interview you because, I mean, I think that you're another one who is just incredibly humble and beautiful, wise, smart, and spends her whole life helping other people.
Well, I thought I didn't really realize how much I came in with until I came across a letter that I wrote my grandmother when my grandfather died, and I was all of 6 years old. And in it, it says, Grandfather isn't dead. He's just, you know, And it goes on to talk about that he'll, you know, he's in another place and he's fine and he's going to be coming back and you'll see him again, you know. And I was six.
I don't even remember.
I couldn't have possibly. I didn't read yet. I mean, I read a little bit.
I'm sure you came in with, you know, the veil partly pulled back,
yeah,
as I did. And, you know, it's really frustrating to me that so many people come in where the veil is pretty much down.
Mm-hmm.
Because, bless their hearts, they're having to start from square one.
Again, yeah, that's true.
I do think that this is a choice, and I think that we can choose in the lifetime that we're in to say, when I come back, if I'm coming back, I want to
mm-hmm.
come back with the veils partly pulled back so that we have a chance of remembering our own wisdom and divinity, even if we still have to go through the process of regathering it again and learning it again in the conscious self, the soul self will remember. You know?
I don't know whether I ever told you this, but I used to ask my teachers at Bible school, this is at the Methodist Church, why isn't anything that Jesus wrote in the Bible?
I love that. I was the same. I grew up, my dad was Baptist.
Isn't that wonderful?
My mother was Methodist, and we became Episcopalian. And I was like one of those kids that said, well, wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
If the only people on earth were Adam and Eve and their three sons, who did the sons marry?
Right.
You know, boy, the Sunday school teachers weren't so thrilled with that one. And it was like, well, wait a minute. If Adam and Eve both ate the apple equally, how come Eve was to blame and women are supposed to suffer and be subservient?
Right.
I was like, duh. You know.
And then pretty soon they weren't calling on you when you raised your hand.
That's exactly right. We think we won't call on her anymore. She's a troublemaker. So,
well, that's why I love your book so much, because it really does explain what I kind of knew about Jesus. I knew that Jesus was what he was in this book. I mean, I knew about the path that he took. I didn't know the details, but I knew that it wasn't just what the Bible said. I knew that there was more information, and I knew that Jesus wrote, and that he was, you know, he was extensively studied, a studied person. You know, he wasn't just barefoot and wandering around and illiterate.
Hammering nails.
Right. Carpenter.
Hammering nails. And you know, this is another thing. The word carpenter is in Aramaic or Hebrew. It's nagger. N-A-G-G, I think, A-R.
Mm-hmm.
And nagger also means not only a builder, but it means a learned man.
Right, and that's really what he was.
Exactly, and this is where the whole concept of the Masons comes from, that
mm-hmm.
you build your inner temple. You are a person who understands how you must, you know, do things on the square, or let us say in truth. They would say on the square, how you must set a good foundation, how you must build things piece by piece if you want it to really last. And this was the code, of course, of the Freemasons, who
right.
were practiced not only in mathematics and construction, but sacred geometry and the inner workings of the principles of the universe. And so it was a metaphor, not just for going and building an outside house, it was a metaphor for our building our inner temple within.
Right, that's true.
So that's where I think the confusion became. A learned man, you know, who was a Mason.
Carpenter.
and somehow it got demoted to just a carpenter.
And people didn't realize at all the background of Jesus' family, Mary. You describe it wonderfully in your book. I just loved it. But Mary's mother being from the Celtic world and running away to the Essene, taking Mary with her to the Essene areas because she was running away from an abusive husband. And
right. That was a very interesting thing I discovered. I go to England every year. I've been there maybe 40 times. And you know, the Druids were very wise, but of course, you know, we have people in every civilization that are conscious and loving and kind, and we have
mm-hmm.
people who are abusive and, you know.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes they marry each other.
emotional clearing work. So Mary's mother was Anna, who was actually a princess from the Guinissa line. And the Guinissa line later became, it was the line that Merlin, 500 years after Jesus, was born into. And if you notice, Gwyn, Issa, here's that word Issa,
right.
Firstborn, and Gwyn has to do with queen or Guinevere, you know, the mm-hmm. Gwyn was a name for woman. So it was a female line of saints and prophets that were mystics. So
right.
he had royalty from the Celtic side, from Anna, mm-hmm. and their shrines and churches and everything set up to Anna, you know, in all to England, and also in Brittany, where her boat landed. And, you know, because the Essenes and some of the other people were coming up back and forth studying up there, doubtlessly probably what happened was Anna wound up in this marriage that we hear was abusive and thought, how can I, you know, get away? Because her husband, I'm sure, had land and property and everything, there was no way she could stay in Britain without inciting a war, so she had to leave the country. So she wound up, you know, using the avenue of another chapter of the Great White Brotherhood, which was mm-hmm. the Essenes, to escape to and to then come reform her life and start over.
Right.
And Joseph of Arimathea, I think, was actually the child that she was pregnant with when she left Britain. But then, so he would have probably been Mary's, like, older half-brother. And then when she got down to Judea and Galilee and she remarried in Essene, Mary was born of that union. So,
now, I wanted to ask a question about Mary. Mary was 14 when she was married to Joseph, who was around 40. And this is a different Joseph, right? This is a...
Yes, the stories that we have from one of the Gnostic Gospels called the Proto-Evangeline mm-hmm. is that basically Mary was dedicated to the temple at around the age of 3 or 4, raised as a holy virgin in the temple, one of, you know, 12 vestal virgins that they had. They say all sorts of things, like she was attended by angels and all of this, and that, you know, they were trying to decide whether to dedicate her for another 12-year period or not, and that the priest went into prayer and was told that he was supposed to, you know, this is at the age of 13, to mm-hmm. find her a husband. And
right.
so he called the masons, all the masons of the brethren that were members that were single that owned a house,
right.
so that the property. And Joseph was older. He had already been married. He'd had 5 mm-hmm. children. And he was, in fact, a mason or a contractor. And he was the last one. And the priest went around and handed staffs to each of the men. And when he handed the last staff to Joseph, suddenly these 2 doves flew out of the staff. And the priest said, "It's you." And Joseph said, "Look, she's young enough to be my daughter. I don't need a wife, you know. I don't need it. Thank you very much." And the priest said, "Hey, are you going to go against the will of God?"
Right.
And so Joseph thought, "Mamma mia, I'm sure."
Yeah.
Although probably not. So he put her in his house
mm-hmm.
for 6 months and went away, just letting her try to mature and
yeah,
grow up
right.
where she could become old enough, mm-hmm. and went and finished a construction project. And when he came back is when he discovered she was pregnant. And,
right.
of course, he was completely horrified. It was like, wait a minute, she's the virgin of the temple. They entrusted her to me. I haven't done a thing with her. I've been gone, and now she's pregnant. And this is why he was like, you know, it was a besmirching of his reputation
right,
and
yeah.
the trust,
well,
plus hers. And
yeah.
that's why, you know, that's why it was very, very upsetting. And then, of course, you know, he was visited and told, hey, you know, she really is who you know, she mm-hmm. says she is. And
well, what is your theory about the pregnancy? I mean, is this something that...
do I think she was a virgin birth?
Right.
Well, okay. Gosh, you do go into deep subjects. Okay.
Well, we don't have much time, but, I mean, I guess the question is, was she truly an immaculate conception, or was she impregnated by a higher being, you know,
right.
using physical methods, you know?
Okay. Well, in the first place, let me say I don't know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
But in the second place, I can tell you my theories.
Okay.
There are... you know, every year, according to our friend Drumvalo Melchizedek, there's something like 17 virgin births in the world that are created basically by somehow pricking the ovum, the egg, and, and then it starts the separation into the zygote. But in this case, you know, there's not a masculine DNA component or a sperm, so what the mother gives birth to is basically a clone of herself, a female. So, you know, that's something that I didn't know until some years ago because of his research. Clearly, Jesus was a man, so where did the sperm come from? I think that it's possible that whether we look at them as angels or we look at them as higher dimensional
advanced beings,
gods and goddesses,
right?
Or you know, higher dimensional.
That's what I think. I think
species,
it was
that his birth was overseen by these beings, because certainly we have the appearance of these shining ones, these shining men at the beginning of the birth, before the birth, at the crucifixion, sitting on the rocks when Mary and Joanna went back. We have the appearance of these beings, and there's even been some evidence of a book called The Talmud of Emmanuel, that during the 40 days and nights in the wilderness, that what happened was that Jesus may have been picked up and taken, let us say, to the temples of the gods, and spent 40 days being really downloaded in a very big way in terms of his mission and his understanding of these higher beings. And then, of course, there are many times when he goes into retreat, and what does he do? He goes to a mountaintop, you know, and he waits, and this light comes down.
Right.
And then there's the reports of the disciples or apostles who saw in the brilliance of this light that came down what appeared to be Moses and Enoch.
Right.
Who
right.
were definitely, we know, favorites of these gods.
Right.
And
that's what
so,
I think, too. I think Jesus' whole time here was overseen by the advanced beings that we are known as gods. I mean, that's, but they're not God. You know, it's...
Yes, not God with a big G. It's the gods with a
with
small
a little G.
G.
There you go.
And I think what had happened is, really, if you follow... And I, you know, I do speak on extraterrestrials and the multidimensional... the old ancient history, the hidden history of the planet. If you follow all this, the gods in general, you know, they did a great deal of good for humanity. I mean, everything that we have, all the sciences, all the arts, everything came from them. But there was a point where their own arguments between the two warring clans became such that there was a kind of a war between two of the gods.
Maybe a nuclear one, too.
Exactly. Yeah. Around 21, 2250 BC. And at the end of that time, when they had actually bombed the Sinai Peninsula where the spaceport was, the two main head gods who were half-brothers, who had had a rival but never acted it out in a negative way, but their sons did, they turned to one another and they said, oh, my God, for all the good we've done down here, look, in the end, we've caused devastation, destruction. Perhaps we should leave man to his own destiny, and we should subtract ourselves from the world of men. So they begin subtracting themselves then, and then they really kind of left more in mass, probably around between 500 and 600 B.C.
Right, yeah.
And so they made certain promises.
So I think Jesus was sent in by some part of this extraterrestrial group.
In order to give a template
to calm
that said, yes, exactly, to say, give a template that says, look, I'm a man, you're a man, you are, it's possible for you to live this higher life. And, you know, let us give you some kind of a template. And because, I mean, really, in a certain way, it's kind of like, you know, we love the gods, and they were, we were their children, we honored them, and then they left, and then we were bereft of our parents, and we were sort of, you know, clueless. We were trying our best to figure it out without the parent coming in and saying, break up this
mess. And I think these were why the four Kumara were sent. To help us, I really do. Well, we're at the end of our hour now, Tricia. We had been interviewing Christian McCannon, her book, Jesus, the Explosive Story of the 30 Lost Years and the Ancient Mystery Religions, has been a real delight to read. And I hope that you will come back on at another time and we can continue our conversation, because we've got a lot more to talk about.
Oh, it's wonderful. I'm here for the next 2 months in Atlanta.
Great.
And for anyone who's interested in checking out my books or CDs or DVDs or talking to me about the Mystery School or my readings, I've done 6,000 readings for people around the world, just contact me at the Tricia McCannon Speaks at yahoo.com email, or my website at www.TrishaMcCannonSpeaks.com. Thank you so much for having me, Susan. It's always a pleasure.
It is. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Susan Gall with Temple of Health Radio Show, and we will be back next week with John Boyk, Cancer Drug Discovery Using Natural Product Mixtures.